If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, almost a million uncommitted U.S. voters want Kamala Harris to stand up for an arms embargo on Israel and an end to the Gaza genocide.
Almost 1 million uncommitted voters and so many of the young people in this country. And then in key swing states, we are looking for Kamala Harris to call for an arms embargo. And it's a very clear demand that we have. And I think she's going to be protested against, interrupted at her events constantly for the next couple of months if she refuses to do that.
And why does Germany criminalize pro-Palestine discourse? It's not about Auschwitz, it's about NATO.
That's really the realpolitik underneath the whole moral narrative. It's about being part of the Western imperialist project. Germany doesn't have the kind of imperial power that the US does, but they wanted to be part of that same project. And Germany is the second biggest arms exporter to Israel after the US. So we're really also just talking about business, about money.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package for Earth News. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. It's the economy, stupid. That was one of three U.S. presidential campaign phrases, certainly the catchiest, coined by Bill Clinton strategist Jim Carville back in 1992. The other two, much less catchy, change versus more of the same, and don't forget health care. 32 years and 8 presidential campaigns later, another rallying cry is on the lips of those who'd likely vote for Kamala Harris if she promises the right things: an arms embargo on Israel and a U.S.-enforced halt to the Gaza genocide. I spoke about the Harris campaign and the Gaza genocide with Medea Benjamin. Benjamin is co-founder and tireless guerrilla activist with the American feminist anti-war group Code Pink. I reached Medea Benjamin in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. Hello, Medea Benjamin. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Nice to be on with you, David.
I was just watching Kamala Harris and speaking to a crowd in North Carolina, talking about lowering food prices, lowering housing costs, lowering taxes for the working class, making it easier for ordinary middle-class people to not simply to get by, but to succeed in all sorts of economic ways, but nothing about curtailing the permanent war economy in North Carolina. And North Carolina is, of course, like all U.S. states, is the military-industrial complex is fully in operation in North Carolina, isn't it? But no mention about that by Kamala Harris.
Well, unfortunately, the economy of so many of our states are dependent on the military. And that's one of the excuses that the leaders of our country use when they say that we have to increase the military budget because these are jobs that we're creating. On the other hand, if we could take what we spend on the military, or at least a couple of $100 billion of that, and put it into other kinds of jobs, we would create so many more jobs than are created by money that goes to the military.
What's your take on Kamala Harris, Medea?
Well, I think we could see that she's been part of the Biden administration. Certainly, she's no lefty like Trump makes her out to be. She's a middle-of-the-road Democrat. She supports the Biden foreign policies that have been so disastrous, especially in the last 10 months on Gaza. But more than that, I think she's a supporter of the status quo. And what we need in this country is something, some more radical change. You know, she has gone back, says now she doesn't support things like Medicare for All. She doesn't support some of the more deep reforms we need to make college education affordable for young people. She doesn't have any plan to deal with the housing crisis we have in the United States. So I don't see her as any kind of savior or bringer of change.
There's been certain talk about Kamala Harris's evolving discourse on the Israeli genocide in Gaza, that she's moving beyond Joe Biden's position and presenting discourse that seems promising in terms of holding Israel accountable. What's your take on this?
Well, it's only words right now. And even Biden has said he calls for a ceasefire. Biden has talked about civilian casualties. Yes, she has said that too many civilians are being killed. But then what do you do about that? Well, what you would do about that is say, and that's why I'm calling for an arms embargo on Israel. That's why I'm calling, under my administration, the United States wouldn't be providing cover for Israel at the United Nations. We would be following the rulings of the International Court of Justice that says that the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza is illegal. But I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for her to say those things.
And she's a prosecutor. You'd think that she'd listen closely to the rulings of the 15 justices, or at least 12 out of the 15 justices at the International Court of Justice, not just in their advisory opinion, but also in their estimation that charges of genocide leveled by South Africa are plausible. And the ICC's issuance of Chief Prosecutor Khan's issuance of arrest warrant applications against Netanyahu and Gallant, you'd think that this would have some kind of impact on her as an attorney, as a prosecutor.
Well, yes, that would be nice. But I think what she's trying to do is really play it both ways. Like when Netanyahu was here, she wasn't the host in the Congress when he made the joint session of Congress address, but she did meet with him. And then she came out and said something like, you know, we still have this great support for Israel, but I will not be silent when it comes to things like civilian casualties. So she was walking her very fine line, which I don't think, well, I know it wasn't enough for those of us who were looking for her to really distance herself. And I think the almost 1 million uncommitted voters and so many of the young people in this country. And then in key swing states, we are looking for Kamala Harris to call for an arms embargo. And it's a very clear demand that we have. And I think she's going to be protested against, interrupted at her events constantly for the next couple of months if she refuses to do that.
What else could she do, Medea Benjamin, aside from simply declaring an arms embargo, right? People say, geez, you know, people like Aaron David Miller say, you know, the United States has just gone to the wall to kind of pressure Benjamin Netanyahu to stop his war, but it's just to no avail. The United States doesn't have anything more at its disposal. Well, what could the United States do beyond simply move beyond applying pressure, moving beyond using leverage to actually bring the war to an end? Because the United States is a party to the war. It isn't simply complicit. It isn't simply an ally of Israel. It's directly engaged. So my question is, right, suppose, you know, Kamala Harris wins in November and you know, along with both houses of Congress, go Democratic. That would be quite something. What could Joe Biden do in his final 4 months and leading up to a Harris presidency that would really totally transform the situation, aside from simply an arms embargo? What could she do?
Well, what Biden needs to do, and he needs to do now, is indicate to Netanyahu that the United States will not come to Israel's aid if indeed they start a war with Iran. And that is absolutely critical. And we need to hear that loud and clear, because we know that the Israeli government has been trying to, for years, to drag the United States into a war with Iran. And whether it's hearing from Kamala Harris about not just we don't want a regional war, but we're not going to get involved in a regional war, or the one who's in charge right now is Joe Biden. You know, he's the one who could pick up the phone and talk to Netanyahu and make it very clear that the U.S. is just not going to do that. And I actually think there is some moves in that direction, because there are many people in the Pentagon who have said over the years that they don't think that Israel could win a war with Iran without the U.S. coming in. And Iran is a very developed country when it comes to their armaments, and they have a huge military. And it certainly would not be good for the Biden administration to be in the middle of a war with Iran during these elections. So I think it's in the interest of the United States to make it very clear to Israel that we won't be following you down this path to insanity. Instead, what we see is, I guess it is Biden who ordered the military to be sending more aircraft carriers to the region, more fighter jets to the region, at the same time that they are saying, we don't want to escalate. Well, if you don't want to escalate, don't start sending those messages to Iran that we are ready to come to Iran's to Israel's aid.
How about a UN Security Council resolution put forward by the United States under Chapter 7? That would be pretty amazing. It's kind of a fantasy scenario, ordering Israel to end its assault on Gaza and declaring the occupation to be over. And this would be an enforceable resolution. I mean, it's perfectly possible a Chapter 7 resolution put forward by the United States. It seems less than likely, less than unlikely, but it could do it. And that would end the occupation, not simply Israel's assault on Gaza. It would end the occupation.
Well, that's what needs to happen, because even if there is a ceasefire, it's not going to end the conflict. I'm in Congress all the time, and there are so many members of Congress who keep saying to us, there was a ceasefire before October 7th. Well, there wasn't a ceasefire. There was oppression of the Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and even inside of Israel proper. So the latest ruling of the International Court of Justice says that this occupation is illegal and that countries are obligated by law not to support this occupation. And so, yes, that's what the United States should do, should use the power of the Security Council. But we all know that there's too strong a lobby so far in the United States, both the Jewish lobby like AIPAC or the Christian Zionists like Christians United for Israel, that have so much influence on our government. But times are changing. We've seen 10 months of a genocide, which has woken up a lot of people to the true nature of the Israeli government, and especially among young people who are not going to be quiet about this. I think even if there is a ceasefire, there's going to be a lot of push for the U.S. government to do something instead of just keep saying we support a two-state solution, when it's so clear Netanyahu is against a two-state solution. The entire Knesset voted overwhelmingly against a two-state solution. There are now more and more violent settlers who are taking over more and more land. And there's about 30% of the people in Israel who say they want to take over Gaza and start settlements there. So this conflict is not going to end just with a ceasefire in Gaza, and it's not going to end in terms of people in the United States and people all over the world calling for something that actually deals with the ongoing oppression of the Palestinian people, whether it's a one state, one democratic secular state, or a real two-state solution, there's got to be something that is more fundamentally changed than just a ceasefire.
Is this just the pro-Israel, pro-Zionist lobby in the United States? Of course, the most powerful sector of the pro-Israel lobby, Zionist lobby in the United States is not Jewish. It's Christian Zionist. But is it just the lobby, or is this just a really, really deeply seated ideological conviction on the part of the American political elite that Israel is just an outpost of American settler colonial power? America is a settler colonial state itself. America identifies deeply with the United States. American political elite identify deeply with Israel and see Israel as the light of the world and, in a place of darkness, kind of us rather than them. So to what extent is this really the problem, which would be a lot more serious than simply that there's a lobby?
Yes, I think you're right, David. It is more serious. It is more deep-seated. It is more of the elite here in the United States identifying with the settler colonial state of Israel, identifying with the people of Israel, still calling them a democracy, still believing that they have a lifestyle similar to ours. They think similar to us. They have, quote, values similar to us, which is quite amazing after what we've seen in the last 10 months, including the kind of torture and gang rape and the horrific conditions in the prisons. But it's also reinforced by the tremendous amount of travel that happens between the elites in the United States going to Israel. You know, Steny Hoyer, who used to be the Speaker of the House, has led delegations to Israel 21 times. I mean, this is a tiny country in Israel. Its outsized influence is quite tremendous. And you see that every politician, when they get elected or even before that, is pressured to go on these junkets to Israel, paid for by a sister group of AIPAC, which is really AIPAC itself, and to see exactly what the Israeli government wants them to see, to form these personal relationships with leaders in the Israeli government, and to come back to the United States saying ridiculous things like, I didn't see any oppression of the Palestinians when I was there. So there are those kinds of ties. And then there's the ties of the military and security interests. Israel, as you know, is so well-developed technologically when it comes to weapons and and security, has been training U.S. police forces for years, has been working with the artificial intelligence community in the United States, has developed such high-tech weapons, and there are so many companies that are joint U.S.-Israeli companies. And so we shouldn't forget the power of that military-industrial security complex that is so enmeshed with the Israeli companies and the Israeli government.
The U.S. economy is really benefiting from the Gaza genocide, isn't it?
Well, the U.S. economy in some ways has become a war economy now for many years.
I guess I'm off target to say the U.S. economy is benefiting from the Gaza genocide, because the U.S. economy is, of course, huge. But the military-industrial economy, the permanent war economy, is benefiting mightily from the Gaza genocide, where, you know, it's being reported more bombs have been dropped, ordnance on Gaza, than was dropped on, you know, in all the theaters of war in the Second World War and, of course, Vietnam.
Right. You know, we, the people, are not benefiting, and certainly the Palestinians are at the receiving end of all of these bombs. But there is a certain sector of our economy, and we started out our conversation talking about that, how There are so many states in this country that are dependent on these jobs from the defense industry, what I call the military or offense industry. And yes, they do create a certain amount of jobs, but it's really the big shareholders that reap the huge profits from this. And it's to the detriment of a healthy economy that would really take seriously the climate crisis that we are dealing with, an economy that would really work for the majority of the American people. So I think, as you clarified, we, the people, are not benefiting by this, but a certain sector is.
Would the American people, whoever they are, support an arms embargo on Israel? Would, I don't know who the American people are, but would it be politically advantageous for the Harris campaign to actually declare outright an arms embargo? Well, it wouldn't be Kamala Harris, it would be Biden, to declare an arms embargo on Israel. Would this sell politically in the United States?
Well, you know that opinion polls really reflect the way questions are asked. But there was a recent opinion poll that looked at the swing states of Georgia, Arizona, and Pennsylvania and asked precisely that question and found that it would be to her advantage. So I do think that it would not be that difficult to explain to the American people why an arms embargo is important. Some people have, quote, softened it, including Bernie Sanders, that said that he would be for an embargo on offensive weapons, meaning he would still be in favor of the Iron Dome, which is about $4 billion of the $17 billion that we have given to Israel, on top of the $3.8 billion that we give every year, on top of the $20 billion in sales that were just authorized by the Biden administration. So, you know, they might want to couch it more in terms of offensive weapons. On the other hand, they have bought into this narrative that Israel is surrounded by enemies in the region, and that's why they've pushed so hard for these Abraham Accords to have a normalization with Arab neighbors. But the way they talk about Iran and Iran's, quote, proxies, which are not proxies, they are mostly independent groups that are opposed to Israel's oppression of Palestinians, but I'm talking about the Houthis, Hezbollah, the militia groups in Iraq, as well as in Syria.
The axis of resistance.
Yes, and both the Republicans and the Democrats have hyped that up so much that it's hard to say we won't sell offensive weapons to Israel, because they come back and say, well, then you won't be allowing Israel to defend itself against these evil forces in the region.
And it's all awfully racist, isn't it?
Well, it's racist, and it's also just a vicious circle, because it's so clear that if you want to stop this, quote, axis of resistance, then just stop the genocide. The Houthis, Hezbollah, they have all said, you stop the attacks, you stop the bombing, you sign a ceasefire, and we will stop. And in fact, Iran, I find it quite remarkable that Iran hasn't responded to the Israeli murder of the political head of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, because it is such an affront to do that in Iran on the day of the inauguration of the new president, that I was sure that Iran would feel obligated to respond right away. And the fact that now they're saying, if there is a ceasefire deal in place, we will not respond. So the evil countries that the U.S. government has painted as so aggressive have, for the most part, been standing down or been saying, we will stop attacks on the ships carrying goods to Israelis, for example, the Houthis, as soon as you stop the genocide. And, you know, that would totally end the conflict in the region. And yet it's not what the U.S. is willing to force Israel to do.
And I also have this idea, Medea Benjamin, both my feet firmly rooted in the clouds, that ending the war in Gaza and ending the occupation and declaring its insistence that Palestinian statehood must happen, this would be things the United States does, would suddenly open up the door, leverage a huge grand deal that would be global with Iran, with China, with Russia, that having shown that the United States is prepared to make this happen, that suddenly the doors would open to something much larger achieved through a global peace conference, bringing in all the official enemies.
Well, wouldn't that be beautiful, David? And that's what we want to work for. Unfortunately, so many of these people in Congress that I meet up with on a regular daily, actually, basis are war hawks. And so they say if they want to get out of the Middle East, it's because they want to put the attention on China, who they see as the enemy. And certainly the Democrats have painted the picture in Ukraine as one where we have to keep supporting the Ukrainians to the bitter end, no matter what that means. And there was not one Democrat, even all the progressives that we have in Congress, there was not one Democrat who voted against the last tranche of $60 billion of our tax dollars to go to Ukraine. So while I think we, the American people, would benefit tremendously if we started a cooperative relationship with China, with Russia, with Iran, as you were stating, we have to do something about the people who are now supposed to be representing us, because they certainly are not thinking in that way. They continue to think in terms of the U.S. has to be the leader, the superpower, the hegemonic force in the world. And the times have changed. We're not that hegemonic force anymore. But those in power seem to not want to confront reality.
And you're saying that you meet with these people in Washington every day in the Congress. Are you having any impact? What do they make of you, and what do you make of them? I mean, is it just the money they're getting? Is it just the, their campaign cash? Or is it something about their headspace, their worldview? It must be.
Well, it's all of that, but at least the part on the money is something that is concrete. And so we put out these videos where we talk to these Congress people and then flash how much money they receive from AIPAC. And a study was recently done. The more money you receive from AIPAC, guess what? The more you are towing the line of pro-Israel no matter what. So we're trying to embarrass these people and make them sign pledges, which we only have maybe about 20 who have signed so far, saying they won't take money from AIPAC. And as we go forward, we want to say that this is money that is destroying our system, distorting our values, skewing our policies, that it's dirty money, and that any politician who wants to consider themselves progressive, or even, there are 100 members of Congress who are part of the Progressive Caucus. None of them should be taking money from AIPAC. But it's going to be a hard push to move in that direction. But there are a lot of groups doing it. I'm with the group Code Pink, but there are also groups like If Not Now, which is young Jewish community. There's Jewish Voice for Peace. There are many of the Muslim groups like American Muslims for Palestine, and other groups like Democratic Socialists of America, all working towards the same goal with the idea of changing U.S. policy, recognizing that right now one of the things we have to focus on is this issue of money in politics.
Medea Benjamin, in closing, I didn't ask you in the beginning, tell me about Code Pink. Who and what is Code Pink? Who and what is Code Pink?
Well, Code Pink is a group that started after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, thinking that if we did our job as citizens and organized, that we could stop our government from invading Iraq. Unfortunately, We did our part, but the government didn't listen to us. The code pink term comes from Bush administration when it had a color-coded alert. I don't know if you remember that, David, but it was code yellow, orange, red. And our code pink was a different way of dealing with the conflict, going after the individuals who attacked us, not invading Afghanistan.